When it comes to writing, it's really easy to procrastinate. The temptation to avoid the terrifying whiteness of the blank page can be overwhelming. Canadian philosopher Mark Kingwell has clearly either never felt that temptation or overcame it, because he's written lots of books, including one called Catch and Release, Trout Fishing, and the Meaning of Life. Kingwell sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about the chapter Boredom, Procrastination, and Losing Your Way.
The problem with procrastination is precisely that the task you should be doing is the one that you can't do. And yet, when you're in a procrastinatory bind, you're perfectly capable of doing all kinds of things, even very productive things, as long as they're the thing not that you have to do. So the idea, in a way, is to trick yourself into achieving things by doing them when you don't have to do them, instead of doing the one thing that you think you have to do. And by doing these rounds of trickery with yourself, you can actually get a lot done. And indeed, that's how I got my dissertation finished.
So this is very different from laziness. It's not as if you don't want to do anything. It's just that you don't want to do the one thing you're supposed to be doing.
That's it, exactly. And I think the best way to conceptualize this is to see it as a conflict between two different orders of desire. So you have a second order desire, which is a desire about a desire. You want to do the thing that you're supposed to do. But you have a first order desire not to do it, or anyway, you lack that first order desire to do it. And this conflict between the first and the second order is what creates the distress of procrastination. And it's precisely the bind within the psyche itself, which means that you stall on that particular task. So it really has almost nothing to do with laziness. It often looks to the world like laziness because you're not doing the thing you're supposed to be doing, but in fact it is a kind of psychic bind.
But as you say, if you can figure out how to sort of trick your own desires, you can sort of find these smaller tasks that will perhaps get you to finish the larger task.
That's one solution. The classical solution, of course, and this is rooted in really ancient philosophy of mind and philosophy of action, is to try and line up your first and second order desires so that the thing you want to do and wanting to want to do that thing are aligned and you go about your business.
But you'll have to explain that. So give me an example of that.
Okay, so suppose I have a task that I'm set to do, and that is, say, cleaning the house. Because of my sense of duty and orderliness, I want to clean the house. So I have a second-order desire about that task. But what I may or may not have is the first-order desire actually to do it. That is, I may want to clean the house or not want to clean the house. Now, I can overcome not wanting to through sheer strength of will, and that's one kind of solution. I can trick myself into doing it while not doing something else. Or in the best case scenario, at least classically, I should simply have that first order desire match my second order desire. So not only do I want to clean the house, I actually want to clean the house. And here I go, getting out the vacuum.
This sounds like the kind of thing that philosophers talk about.
Well, you know, it's as old as, at least as old as Plato's dialogues, because we know in Plato's Republic, he talks about a character called Leontius, who goes outside the walls of the city and sees some corpses piled after a battle. And he can't tear his eyes away from this ghastly sight. It's maybe the first recorded instance of rubbernecking. And what he says, actually, is he denies and denounces his eyes. So he says, he turns angrily and he says, okay, take your fill of this beautiful sight, you horrible things, his eyes. So he's got a conflict there between his desire to look and his desire not to want to look. And in that particular case, his will is insufficiently strong to stop that first order desire from taking over. And that's what philosophers call weakness of the will, or akrasia. And procrastinatory states of mind are intimately related to that kind of akrasia.
Now, there are also some larger, deeper issues that come into this discussion. I want to quote a passage from your book. You write, "Procrastination most often arises from a sense that there is too much to do and hence no single aspect of the to-do worth doing. Underneath this rather antic form of action as inaction is the much more unsettling question whether anything at all is worth doing." I mean, you're really getting at the futility of existence, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's I really think this is the existential beast that's crouched in the lair of an everyday experience. The initial experience might be something on the order of you open the fridge and you say there's nothing to eat because you can't fix your desire on any particular thing, even though, of course, there are in fact, many things to eat. And the same thing can arise in your experience of a task. Lots of things to do in any given day. In fact, most of us feel that we're overburdened with things to do. But no single one seems to catch our attention in such a way that we can get our desires behind it. And once that starts to chip away at your sense of purpose, it really does start raising these questions about, you know, all the things that we spend all of our time and energy thinking about doing and maybe even doing, which of them, if any, are worth doing at all?
Maybe there's no point to doing anything.
Well, the famous tag that procrastination is the thief of time strikes me as relevant here because so much of what we do is a function of an immersion in a temporal structure. So we make appointments, we have Blackberries and date books and schedules, and that keeps us really from thinking too deeply about whether any of those appointments are worth keeping or whether those tasks are actually worth doing. And this is what we do to get through the days. But I do think that underneath this fairly ordinary experience of procrastination, there is something really quite profound that strikes us with full existential force.
Well, it sounds like procrastination is perhaps one of the great issues for philosophers, which makes me wonder whether philosophers themselves are more likely to procrastinate, or perhaps procrastinators are more prone to become philosophers.
I think both things are true, and it relates also to experiences like boredom, which has an unexpectedly deep philosophical payoff. Most people think of procrastination as something to be disapproved of. So, and the famous inversion of that is probably De Quincey's, where he's in The Fine Art of Murder, he says, you know, something like, once you let yourself commit an act of murder, you'll soon find yourself by steps committing even more serious things like incivility and procrastination. And he knew whereof he spoke because De Quincey was one of the great procrastinators of his age and yet also tremendously prolific. And when you take those two facts into account, you see that is a portrait of a man in a certain kind of perpetual crisis. You know, he's fleeing the deep philosophical lesson of procrastination by trying to work it out through production. And in a way, he's a quintessentially modern figure. But yes, philosophers, I think, they ignore this kind of experience at their peril. And the best philosophers are the ones who take this kind of everyday experience and really start to probe it in the way that we have been doing.
Now, you suggest that actually, if you're looking for a close relative of procrastination, it's not boredom, it's actually addiction. Can you explain that connection?
All of weakness of the will, addiction, procrastination, and boredom can be conceptualized in this difference between first and second order desires. So the close kinship between addiction and procrastination is that the addict, like the procrastinator, has a problem where his first order and second order desires don't line up. In the addict's case, it's the reverse. So the addict has a first-order desire for his or her drug, but usually has a second-order desire not to have that first-order desire. So, you know, I want to do the line of coke, but I don't want that because I know it's bad. So the addict is, in a sense, in a similar kind of spiral, only with the polarity reversed, and each action of giving in to that conflict furthers his or her immersion in the addiction, just like each inaction on the case of the procrastinator perpetuates the spiral of procrastination.
Well, it also raises the question of whether there's something pleasurable about procrastination, about not doing the thing. I mean, can that, I don't know, create joy in our lives, even though we feel guilty about it?
Yeah, you know, you wish that were true. I mean, in a way, the addict is better off than the procrastinator because at least he can take the first order pleasure in the experience of the drug. Most procrastinators are racked by guilt because the external disapproval is matched by internal disapproval. And that's why it's not the same as idleness, for example. The true idler is able to say, what I'm doing now is nothing. And that's a kind of new scale of value, a new order of activity. The procrastinator is more like the slacker, the person who is aware that he should be doing something else but isn't. And that awareness colors the whole experience of not doing it, such that the procrastinator can never really take any deep pleasure in not doing the thing that he should be doing because the shouldness of that hangs over the whole experience.
So that person becomes a moral failure in a way.
Exactly. So one of the solutions that I haven't mentioned so far is simply to abandon your projects and actually be an idler. And of course, the idler never procrastinates. The idler is simply doing nothing always.
Seems the great dilemma is always, how can you be both an idler and still maintain ambition? Can you have both those things?
I think you can. I'm blessed because being a professor of philosophy, in a way, is one of the few professions where you get rewarded for being idle, really. I mean, you know, you're writing articles and teaching, but in some larger sense of what the world considers work, you're doing something idle. I think that's a proud banner to bear. But the idea that somehow ambition is always about achievement in measurable ways itself needs to be queried. We're here for a mortal span whose length we know not, and our ambition should really be to make the most of the time that we have, not knowing how much of it there is. And there is no time to be spent feeling shame at not doing things. You should find things that you can do, however, whatever method works for that, and enjoy doing them.
Mark Kingwell is the author of Catch and Release: Trout Fishing and the Meaning of Life. He teaches philosophy at the University of Toronto, and he talked with Steve Paulson